Hi, Mickey.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
Pretty good.
Well, good. Listen, I may change that here in pretty short order. I'm afraid I'm going to have to bring up Brokeback Mountain just real quickly.
Go ahead. Make my day.
Okay, everybody knows you said it would never gross more than $50 million. I checked today, and it's at $60 million, and I was hoping you could maybe help me with a little conceptual issue here. 60 is more than 50, is that right?
Yeah, but I thought I've already not only admitted that 50 was an improvident prediction, but that it's going to beat 50, it's going to beat 60, it's going to beat 70. But then I moved the goalpost.
Your fallback position.
You missed the goalpost moving and
your
the fallback
position is it won't be hitting the red states.
Right, and the distributor's been going around predicting for weeks and weeks and weeks, oh, it's a hit in the red states, it's a hit in the red states. Now that it's finally going wide and it's not being a hit in some red states and it didn't get the Oscar bump that everybody expected, the same guy who's been spoon-feeding this to the press is now saying, oh, we have to fall back on our core markets. You can't really expect it to do well going wide. So I claim that the prediction that it would not, in fact, break out to red states is gaining some traction.
But do you actually have red state data here, or did you just find some very obscure town in some red state where it anecdotally was reported that it had not done well?
First, it was the town of Clovis, New Mexico,
okay.
Right near Texas,
Texas. The bellwether of the nation, I've always said.
Well, it's a small, agricultural town where if it really plays in the red states, it would play there. It's not a college town.
But
it's
see,
not,
you're
you know,
already adopting the second
bastion.
Fallback position that I predicted you would adopt, which is to go from saying it won't play in the red states to saying, well, it may do well in the cities in the red states, but not in the Clovises of the world. Are you officially back to that fallback position?
Well, I claim that yes, university towns in Montana and famously liberal towns like Missoula, where it packed in 150 people a showing. If you're impressed with that, you're impressed with that.
I'm awed.
This idea that somehow this is going to change minds in Bush country, which is the idea behind Frank Rich's point, or that it's going to validate the fact that minds have been changed, is not yet borne out. It could still happen, but it has not yet been shown. And in fact, the studio is now back in office.
Yeah.
There was a study apparently in a Byron York book about where Fahrenheit 9/11 played, and that did much bigger business than Brokeback. And apparently, there's internal documents showing it really only played to predictable blue state audiences. When all this is over, somebody should go through the data, and I bet you'll be able to show that. At least 75% of the audience was a predictable blue state audience, in part because, as Matt Iglesias pointed out, the audience for all movies is mainly blue state. It's at least 60%, 55-60% to start with. And this red state breakout that they've been pushing just didn't happen.
Sounds like I hit a raw nerve there, man. Hey,
I'm loaded for bear.
Speaking of which, things are getting a little personal between you and Andrew Sullivan, I'd say.
A little personal. He's questioning my. He's saying I'm uncomfortable in my sexuality.
And you were saying he was no fun to work under.
Well, you worked under him, Bob. What did you think?
I was happy as a clam.
Okay, I was. He was a very good editor because he has a hack sensibility, which is okay. We'll fix this paragraph and blow it out the door, and there'll be another one tomorrow. But he does have a hack sensibility, and one part of having a hack sensibility is. Any weapon to hand. So he makes one argument one day and then the opposite the next day, whatever happens to suit him in whatever debate he's in. And that's sort of I think it's something left over from Oxford, where the whole point is to win the debate, not to be principled.
Will you do me a favor? Don't say that on your blog. Let's keep it here, and then he'll have to link to blogging heads when he replies.
You're incredibly cunning, except that assumes he's going to take the debate, which he's probably smart enough not to.
I will email him until he does.
He has many admirable qualities, but this is not one of them.
Well, linking is one of them. That's all I'm counting on.
The quality of grabbing any weapon that happens to be at hand, even if it contradicts the position he took the week before. His latest one was saying that Brokeback wasn't a left-wing political movie, wasn't political. Well, next week he's going to be talking about how Hollywood is in the thrall of liberals.
Well, there I think it's a question of whether you're talking is or ought. And he, of course, it is his position that it shouldn't be a liberal movie. In other words, conservatism properly defined should be fairly libertarian, should be suspicious of government intervention to constrain lifestyles and so on. So I think that's kind of what's going on there.
Right. No,
but you're,
that
you're right. As a matter of actual coalitional politics in America, it's, you know, the anti-gay rights people are on the right. They're Republicans, by and large.
Right. And sort of if one's tempted to say that if he's uncomfortable with that, it's his problem. But he shouldn't deny the reality. That's the point. I agree with that. I forgot to set the timer, but if the timer were set, it would be raining now. Yeah.
So we're moving on to what? The
cartoons.
Okay. The cartoon that has unleashed so much Muslim rage around the world.
Yes.
I don't have all that much to say about that. I do have. I do think there's a little too much self-congratulation in the West about our strict adherence to unconstrained speech. I mean, I think there's a tendency to dichotomize and say, look, there's the modern world where we live and we understand the importance of free speech, and then there's the Muslim world. I mean, the fact is, we have taboos, you know, of speech. All societies do. I mean, you can certainly imagine cartoons, say, a cartoon that denigrated some minority ethnic group that no reputable American newspaper would run. And if one did run it, and there were demonstrations and they got out of hand, and, you know, the house of the cartoonist and the newspaper's editor were firebombed or something, a lot of people would say, you know, they have only themselves to blame. That was stupid and disgusting. So it's not, I just don't think it's quite as binary as people say. There are things that are, in fact, sacred in our society. And for that matter, I haven't seen a lot of cartoons ridiculing Jesus in our newspapers.
There's one on the cover of Rolling Stone this month. It's rapper Kanye West who's dressed up as Jesus Christ. I mean, it's not funny, but it's mocking. It's subversive.
But that's almost not the equivalent, because there's no Christian ban on depicting Christ. But anyway, the other thing is political speech is at times very, very carefully policed here through informal sanctions. I mean, after 9/11, you basically weren't allowed to criticize Bush or the country with any ferocity. Bill Maher said something that was actually pretty defensible and I think lost a TV show over it.
Well, formal, but there's a big difference between formal and informal, Bob. I mean, if somebody, Bill Maher was not thrown in jail, he wasn't firebombed, everybody agreed he had a right to say what he said. He didn't have a right to a TV show if he managed to annoy people.
No, but there is a fine line between, I mean, like I said, imagine the case where there's demonstrations, one of them gets out of hand, and something violent happens. I'm saying if there is not sympathy for the victim of that, that's a way that an informal norm is expressed. And I'm saying there are cases where that would be the case in America. And also, I mean, it's a very small fraction of the world's Muslims who have expressed their opinion violently, of course.
But various governments have felt the need to appease them, although they...
Well,
I
right,
agree
and they've stoked it, some of yeah, this as I, well.
Sorry?
And they have stoked some of the demonstrations as well.
Right, right.
Probably the Iranian government and almost certainly the Syrian government.
Yeah. Some of them, like Ayatollah Sistani, have been very responsible and called for restraint, and even while condemning the cartoon. Apparently that's because in Shiite Islam, depictions of Muhammad are not as radically prescribed. Apparently in some Shiite artifacts, there are in fact depictions of Muhammad.
Yeah.
So that may explain Sistani's relative responsibility. But the basic point is, first, condemning people is not the same as suppressing them. So, like, Chris Hitchens goes off of the U.S. government because we condemned the cartoons. Well, why can't we condemn the cartoons? Doesn't Bush have the right to say what he thinks of the cartoons? Doesn't the administration have the right to have a position? So there's this conflation.
He has the right, but people like Hitchens think it's an ill-advised act of appeasement, in effect. They think it will give positive reinforcement to rioting throngs.
Was that what you think?
I think it's a very tough call as to what the right thing to do is.
Yeah.
But I actually thought the Bush administration reacted to this much the way it would have reacted if there had been a comparable outrage in America where somebody offended Christians with some depiction of Jesus and Mary Magdalene or something.
Right, and why isn't that right?
Well, right,
why isn't
fine.
That the right
I mean, that's my point. I think Bush said roughly what he would have said in the comparable case in America. I think he would have added in America, but, of course, they have the legal right to express what they express, but he would only have done that because if he hadn't, then everybody would have said, are you trying to constrain free speech in America? And he would have wanted to make that clear. But basically...
Well, I think he did say that in this case,
I didn't hear that part of the statement.
I think it was in there. It was just the second sentence that never gets reprinted. But
if he said that, then I don't see how anybody could complain. I mean,
I agree.
That's probably his actual feelings about the situation.
I agree, but I don't understand why you said there's no difference between a government that issues that and a government and a society where they says that the cartoonist should be put to death.
I didn't say there was no difference.
It's a pretty yawning gulf, I would say. And also the way that all of Denmark is held responsible.
Wait a second.
For
the number of Muslims in the world who think that this guy should be put to death, I would suspect is pretty small. And that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about you just see this in the writing, especially I think from the right, the idea that we have this modern liberal society where we understand that unconstrained speech is the best. Well, we actually don't, and no society does. It's a question of what the informal sanctions are and what speech is sanctioned.
But Bob, if the cartoonists had published that in the middle of Saudi Arabia or Afghanistan or Iran, they would not be alive today. I mean, how can you say that it's just a
you
question
mean because
of
it's against the law?
They're blasphemous. They would be killed. Wouldn't they? Or thrown in jail or something.
Well,
look,
people have certainly been imprisoned in America for opinions they expressed. And, you know, I mean, look at the...
We've done a pretty good job of pushing it as far as one can push it.
Who I have?
America has done a pretty good job of pushing taboos as far as they can be pushed, and then coming up with new taboos to break.
Lately,
that's
but also
specialty.
That's another thing. That's a fairly recent development. Look at America 50, 60 years ago, and it's a very different story. So again, the point is just that modernization is a gradual, incremental process, and it's anyway. I just thought there was a little too much self-satisfaction.
Well, there's also incredible self-satisfaction that now the Europeans are getting theirs. I must admit, I share this self-satisfaction.
Oh, I don't.
After decades of condemning us for inflaming Muslims and not understanding the root causes, they've inflamed them like we never did. The demonstrations against the cartoon were almost bigger than the demonstrations against the Iraq invasion in some nations.
Yeah, well.
And they're having to come to grips with, you know, the...
I'm proud to say I felt no Schadenfreude myself.
Okay, well, you never do.
That's just the kind of guy I am.
It's because of your
Buddha-like...
That's
why millions of Americans turn to our site every week for guidance.
Your Buddha-like equanimity.
Yeah.
It's sort of like Andrew Weil. I see you as an Andrew Weil figure.
With a little Buddha thrown in, yeah.
Yeah, okay. You had a point to make about oil.
Yeah, oil. Well, it's 2 points. John Tierney wrote this column today in the Times trying to debunk Bush's argument for weaning ourselves from oil. He said, for example, that you don't have to worry about a country like Iran using oil as a weapon because they really can't afford to withhold oil from the world market for any length of time. And that's what it would take to deprive us of its benefits, because even if they don't sell it to us, they're selling it to anyone, still lowers the price, we benefit from that, and so on.
There was an op-ed by Mel Levine that said the same thing.
Yeah, no, that's a point I've been making myself for a long time, because I've never understood why people say that, for example, we have to worry about our relationship with Venezuela because they sell oil. I mean, as long as they sell it to somebody, I don't see what it matters, and yet lots of people talk as if it did, so there may be something I don't understand. But anyway, there's an argument he did not address is the argument that, and I think this is kind of the Tom Friedman argument, that oil is a pillar of authoritarian regimes that we don't want to see remain in power. And that if if these regimes didn't have oil, they would have to find prosperity for their countries by plugging their countries into the global economy in a more fine-grained way. And in the long run, I think that would be conducive to, you know, political liberty eventually, and would probably undermine the authoritarian regimes in the process, and would just lead to a healthier situation.
No, I agree that, that argument makes sense. My objection to it is that it's, again, a question of degree. I analogize it to welfare reform, and of course, like everything. In welfare reform, you could cut people off completely, and then they had to change and go to work. $20 a barrel oil, which is what Tom Friedman says is going to do the trick, is not a complete cutoff. It's still $20 a barrel of oil. They're still going to be making billions of dollars off of the oil economy. And we had $20 a barrel oil in, you know, as recently as 2002, and for all the end of the 20th century, we had $20 a barrel oil, and it didn't force the countries to change. So I wouldn't be wildly optimistic about unplugging them from the oil economy and forcing themselves to plug into the grid.
Yeah, no, I would say probably the lower the price, the better, but I think you're right. There's a second problem with that rationale, which is just that its solution is less within our control than the other, they're using oil as a weapon is a problem, then all we need to do is wean ourselves from it, then we'll be completely insulated from that as a weapon. But if the Friedman scenario is the issue, and I think that is the issue, then and lowering the price of oil is what you want to do, well, the price of oil, unlike America's dependence on oil, is determined by the world oil market, and we have less leverage over that.
That's a very good point. So even if we become completely self-sufficient, oil will still be fairly expensive because other countries won't.
Yeah. Now, on the other hand, I think still, to the extent that we foster the development of alternative technologies, then the whole world, if they're cost-efficient, the whole world will buy into them and so on.
Yeah.
And also, we are such a big part of the oil market that I think it's worth doing. But I also have a point about how you go about doing it. You and Matt Iglesias, I think, kind of agreed that the idea of having legislators choose alternative energy technologies and subsidize them is not going to have a happy ending, judging by the criteria by which legislators make decisions.
Right.
And I think, Matt, maybe you were saying that a gas tax, a gasoline tax, would be better than you just let the market decide what the best alternatives are and just discourage people from using oil. I have a problem with a gasoline tax. I have two problems. One is that it tends to be kind of regressive. There are a lot of lower-income people who use a lot of gasoline. Secondly, you're not really reaching people at the best point in their decision-making process, it seems to me. I mean, most people, when they pull up to a gas pump tomorrow, it's not an especially discretionary purchase. You know, they just have to drive to work 30 miles every day, and there's no public transportation, and they don't do a lot of frivolous driving around. B, they're not going to buy a new vehicle anytime soon. It's just not in their financial planning, and that's the other way you would exercise influence. So I think the tax credit, whatever, should come at the point of purchase of the automobile, and that would also allow you to make it a less regressive thing because, for example, you could tax the purchase of really pricey gas guzzlers more than not-so-pricey gas guzzlers.
But that's that takes an incredible long time to filter down into actual huge savings in fuel economy if you're only affecting new cars.
But you're also affecting how much car companies invest in hybrid technologies and so on. And I'm just arguing that in any event, the other incentive is a very blunt instrument, and it's not going to have much effect either because people are going to go, well, to cut down on the amount of gasoline I spend this week, I'm going to go buy a new car.
Well, but eventually, I mean, applying my first law of journalism, which is always assume that everybody's like me and generalize wildly from my personal experience, I drive a car that gets 13 miles to the gallon. Okay, not very good. I'm paying through the nose right now, but you're right. It's in little increments, so I pay it. But at some point, if gas went up to $4 or $5 a gallon, I would trade in my $6,000 used sports car for a $6,000 used Toyota that gets twice the mileage.
Well,
and other people
at some
like
point
that.
You would, but it hasn't happened yet. I mean, the other thing I'd say is everybody considers this a long-term project, and if you just look 6 years down the road, probably most car owners will buy a new car within 6 years. And if you make if you make the incentive strong enough, it seems to me this could really work. And it could be revenue neutral if you want. The taxes on the gas guzzlers could provide for very substantial credits on hybrids and so on. I think you could, if you were willing to get serious about it, you could really change the composition of you know, vehicular America in 5 years.
Greg Easterbrook had a simpler, quicker solution, which was fairly authoritarian, but just required everybody to pump up their tires to 32 PSI. It would immediately save, you know, a couple miles to the gallon, immediately, without any cost, except people would have to pump up their tires.
And is there a downside to pumping them up?
Yeah, the ride is rougher.
Oh.
But so what?
Yeah.
Gotta sacrifice.
Amen.
Okay.
So we solved that problem. Your skepticism will slowly fade as you reflect on my idea.
Okay, I think it's going to well up, but we'll see. I heard Reza Aslan, who wrote a book called No God But God about Islam, talk about Iran.
Mm-hmm.
He's Iranian, and he's a Muslim. And he was very, very persuasive that I'm imposing this analogy on him, but Iran is like Cuba. In other words, if we've had tough sanctions in place for 30 years against Cuba, and it has done nothing to change the regime, because it just gives the regime an excuse to, you know, mobilize the people in opposition. Whereas if we'd locked them, if we killed them with kindness by, you know, trading with them and opening them up to a capitalist sort of death embrace of kindness, Castro would be gone by now. Iran is in the same situation. The mullahs are somewhat precarious. He said that the president, who we're so worried about, has absolutely no power, and everybody in Iran knows this. He's just a figurehead. The mullahs have the real power. And if we traded with them, you know, they're like Castro. The thing Castro fears most is an end to the embargo. The thing they fear most is an end to sanctions, where there'd be, you know, liberal trade and a rising middle class and aspirations, and then they, you know, then they couldn't possibly stay in power, was his argument. That seemed completely powerful logic to me. The only issue is, would they get the bomb before this regime change occurred?
Well, right. That's the problem I was going to point out, is that it's a long-term strategy I'd probably applaud. It so happens, though, that he's trotting it out at a moment when we're trying to sharply influence Iranian behavior, and one of the few instruments we have is the threat of sanctions, one of the few instruments short of military
right.
ones.
But if you read the New York Times piece where it basically said we're resigned to having Iran get the bomb, we just want to delay it until after there's a regime change.
Yeah.
Well, sanctions are a good way to delay it, but they may be a really bad way to bring about the regime change. So if you want to get, you know,
I'm not sure they're going to be a good way to delay it either, personally. But yeah, I guess that's our hope. I mean, I'm not sure how delighted we should be about nuclear arms spreading to another country anyway. But I mean, even if we happen to like the regime that's in power when it spreads, but I guess the scenario is that. That you know, this is the beginning of a new era in Iran, and from there on, you have stable democracy or something.
So then Iran becomes like India, having the bomb. We're not worried that India has the bomb.
Yeah.
I interpreted that New York Times article as being the administration telling Israel, it's your baby. We're not going to attack Iran. If you want to do it, go ahead. But we are resigned to them getting the bomb. You have bigger fish to fry than we do.
I actually took it as, I think it was David Sanger, getting one quote out of a guy and turning it into a story. kind of offhand, unguarded quote and turning it into a story. But maybe you're right, and it was an extremely sophisticated way to send a message to Israel rather than picking up the phone.
You can go either way on the New York Times. Sometimes there's a really deep game being played behind every story, and sometimes there's, as you suggest, nothing at all.
Yeah. So where does that leave us in the scheme of things?
That
have we solved the Iran problem?
No, but we've. I just think this kill them with kindness Cuba solution is nobody's talking about it.
Well, I think it's always been one side of the argument. And there's also the complaint that the Bush administration has not responded to overtures emanating from moderates in Iran. lately, or over the last 4 or 5 years. As you know, it's part of my religion that economic engagement is usually benign.
No, right. That's why I thought it would appeal to you.
It appeals totally, man.
Okay.
I love you. Thank you.
Okay.
Now, on this wiretapping thing.
Right.
You've probably been paying enough attention to the Senate hearings or whatever they are to say something intelligent, but I've only been paying enough attention to ask you this question.
Right.
Have we had, in your entire memory, an attorney general who is such a transparent political hack as Alberto Gonzalez? You can go all the way back to Nixon and John Mitchell. You can go further. I mean, as transparent a political hack.
Yeah, no, he's a Harriet Myers crony without Harriet Myers' character. I mean, everybody hates Gonzalez. The right hates Gonzalez for exactly the same reason that the left hates him, which he's an unprincipled political hack, an affirmative action hire who's just trying to avoid screwing up so Bush can reward him with a Supreme Court appointment. He doesn't seem to have any guts at all, and nobody has any faith that he brings any independent principled conscience to bear on any of these issues. So you're completely right about him. I mean, he has only one friend in the United States who happens to be the president.
Yeah, and, you know, I used to think with Ashcroft that, hey, it's scary to have a religious zealot as your attorney general, but now I know that there actually are scarier things, and that's somebody with no principle whatsoever. And, in fact, apparently, I mean, I only glanced at these stories a week or two ago, but Ashcroft, they were having trouble selling this wiretapping scheme to Ashcroft, right?
Well, they approached him in his hospital bed, and he told them, no, I back up my staff in opposing this program.
Yeah.
Then they worked something out.
I never bring him back.
That's why, but that shows you how stupid liberal vilification of conservatives can be.
I retract everything I said about that guy, except that he's not a great singer.
But the hearing yesterday was basically nothing. Emily Bazelon notes it was just a big kabuki where the senators, make speeches and then don't follow through. The difficult issue here, and what everybody seems to be dancing around, and I'm going to deploy the moose for this issue, which is symbolizes the uncomfortable truths, is that the Constitution itself might be obsolete. Everybody's sort of talking about, well, why couldn't you do this under the statute? Well, maybe the problem isn't you couldn't do this wiretapping under the statute. You could not satisfy the Constitution's requirements of probable cause with the sort of wiretapping we need to fight terrorism. The Constitution was written before there was the threat of terrorism. All the judicial decisions that have been calcified into law interpreting what probable cause means happened before the threat of international terrorism. Now we need to search people's emails and phone calls without probable cause. We need to go through 10,000 in order to catch 10 people. Those are 10 important people. The Washington Post implied that this showed it was a bankrupt program because we went through all these thousands to get only 10 people. Well, some right-wing blog, I think it was Decision 05 and maybe Right-Wing Nut House, I'll link to them, pointed out that's a good ratio. If you actually catch 10 people for 10,000, that's a triumph of technology. But the Constitution won't permit it, so maybe the problem is the Constitution either has to be rewritten or they have to come up with some fig leaf to drastically reinterpret it.
Well, I mean, first of all, of course, the reason nobody's talking about that is because the Bush administration won't even admit that this thing is at odds with this law, which is obvious to most people. But here's an argument that relaxing the probable cause standard would actually be inimical to victory in the war on terrorism. If you relax it considerably, it seems like you're going to see the detainment in America, or the wiretapping in America, of more American Muslims who turn out to have no connection with terrorism. And I think
the great
hidden threat that hardly anybody talks about is that American Muslims will begin to feel so persecuted that they will join the global jihad. That would be disaster. And I think that's something we should be sensitive to.
I agree, but first, people don't know they're being wiretapped. Their phone call is run through a computer.
Everything comes out these days, Mickey. Look at this program. The world is just more transparent.
We still don't know what. This is a bad example of that. We still don't know even what this program is, Bob. We don't know if it's a data mining program. We don't know if it looks at the envelope information around a phone call and looks for certain keywords.
We may learn more. I don't know who's testifying today, but...
The hearings are over. There is no more testimony.
Yeah, but anyway, Mickey, it almost doesn't matter if we can point to specific individuals, because when you are a minority group and you have reason to feel persecuted, the tendency is to imagine that it's going on even in the absence of direct evidence. So if there's kind of aggregate evidence, just in terms of the number of phone calls that we know are being wiretapped or the standards that we know are prevailing, I still think, you know, that would be trouble, and it would lead to an attitude among some American Muslims that would be very unhealthy in the long run. I think there's already more feeling in that community than you realize that they are singled out in airport lines.
Well, I'm sure there's self-appointed, self-aggrandizing people who are whipping up that sentiment in order to bolster their political position.
And they're going
to
be there for the rest of eternity, and so we have to take that part of the equation into account.
And maybe that's why Bush is trying to go out of his way to say that no... One reason why they try to go out of their way to say that no domestic-to-domestic calls are being tapped, or to sort of... They don't quite go up to that, but they virtually assure people that that's... what's happening. There's an alternative strategy rather than not wiretap anybody, to just wiretapping a few people, an alternative strategy is to wiretap everybody. You know, if people in Beverly Hills who aren't Muslims are getting wiretapped, maybe the Muslims will feel less aggrieved and picked on.
So you're saying literally wiretap everyone?
Well, I'm saying there's always an alternative strategy, which is rather than not search anybody in the airport line, search everybody in the airport line.
Well...
And I agree that that's a problematic strategy, too, because you wind up wasting a lot of resources. But, you know, if you just have computers run phone calls, maybe we should just go straight to a echelon system where every phone call and fax is run through a computer.
And, Mickey, you wouldn't find that creepy?
It's mildly creepy, Bob, but I was convinced by your book, Non-Zero, that some sacrifices in privacy are essential if we're going to fight terrorism. Are you backing off your own book?
Now that I got the plug out of you, we can move on, Mickey. No, I'm not.
It's
just a very delicate problem. And one of the morals of that story is that hatred and discontent at the grassroots level are more lethal than ever. They can, you know, hatred is just kind of a self-organizing thing. And you just have to pay attention to that side of the equation. I mean, that doesn't speak to the point you're making at that. I mean, as to how creepy we should find it if all of our phone calls are being monitored by computers, but I think most people will find that self-evidently creepy.
I don't know. I mean, I don't put anything in an email now. Ever since Bill Gates' emails were subpoenaed and read in court, I don't put anything in an email now, even to my closest friend, even to you, Bob, that I wouldn't want to have published, you know, on the web for all the world to see.
So is it okay if I publicize all the emails you've sent me?
We can talk about that offline.
Okay, but don't send it in an email. We should talk about it.
The point is, people's expectations as to what is private in email have been radically diminished. We've learned to live with it. It's not the end of the world.
Well, it's also the fact that any given person may forward an email of yours. That isn't just a government issue. Email has always been considered by knowledgeable people a very insecure form of communication.
Right. Well, so now
more than
now
a letter, more than a phone call.
So, yeah, but email is still useful, and we don't find it that creepy after a while. And then so phone calls are now like emails.
I would not like it if every one of my emails were going through a government computer.
They're already going through, you know, an antivirus computer and a spam blocker computer.
That's a little different, Mickey, than searching my emails for their political content.
Well, the innocent have nothing to fear, Bob. No, it doesn't creep me out. I don't understand. We may have different thresholds of privacy, but you know, given the terrorist threat, something like the echelon system doesn't creep me out.
Okay.
Okay.
There you have it. There's one more thing I want to say. Which is, just quickly, have you seen this? I know it's a ways after the State of the Union address now, but that's my only peg for this. In a State of the Union, right before a State of the Union address, a year or two ago, while Bush was walking the podium, he stopped and kissed Joe Lieberman. Have you ever seen that video?
No. This is well before Brokeback Mountain.
It's a great video. it's great entertainment. And I was going to ask you if you had a theory as to what was going on when in Bush's mind when he did that. But if you haven't seen it, I can't ask.
Well, Lieberman has been a strong ally of the administration, obviously. What do you think is going on?
Well, yeah, but I don't think you generally, you know, Washington politicians don't always nuzzle allies in public, do they? I mean,
Not actual osculation, no.
No. It's kind of, I mean, to call it a kiss is, well, we'll let our viewers, I'll stick it in, we'll let our viewers decide. And what I would like from you at some point in the future is a theory as to what was going on in Bush's mind. And maybe if our viewers have any ideas, they can email them to...
Well, but there's that famous anecdote from Texas, which I can't quite repeat on the air, but it involved the lieutenant governor saying, I'm sorry, Governor Bush, I'm going to have to screw you on this bill. And Bush got up, walked across the room, and kissed the guy and said, if you're going to screw me, you're going to have to let me kiss you first.
Is that true?
That's a true anecdote. So he's a comfortable guy, you know? He's
very comfortable with his sexuality.
Confident, yes.
Unlike some people we know.
Unlike some people. But nobody in this conversation.
No.
Okay.
So we'll you know they can there's an email address now on the website a feedback address to which people could send their explanations if they were so inclined for what was going on in Bush's brain.
Great.
If I can find that clip and insert it.
Cool. Well, as they say in Persian, I kiss you from afar.
I can't quit you, man.
Okay. See you later.
See you around.